This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, where each week we visit with veterans of World War II. You know what the idea is by now. We want to honor their service and sacrifice to our country when our country needed it the most. We, of course, want to preserve their stories for posterity and hopefully along the way, maybe inspire some of the rest of us to live up to that legacy that's been given to us by the greatest generation. And speaking of legacies, I think you're going to be impressed by the one you're going to hear about today. It's a little different. Every once in a while, we talk about books on this program, and we're going to spend the first half of the program doing that this week. Not my book. It's still out there. You know that, but we're not talking about that. This, I think, for this audience, will be a much more interesting book and maybe bring back some memories of your own. And maybe you've been shuffling through papers that your father left behind or your grandfather or your grandmother and found some things that you didn't quite know what to do with. Well, our guest today knew exactly what to do with some treasures that she discovered not too long ago. Want to welcome in Lisa Sparr, who joins us from the other side of the country today to talk about her book, World War II Radio Heroes. Now, Lisa, first of all, who were the radio heroes of World War II, or at least in the context of your book, who were those people?
Well, thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me on. A very warm welcome to everybody. The heroes that we talk about in this book are, and I say, so-called ordinary men and women. You might think of them as men and women and also young people, teenagers, who sat in their living rooms and their dens during World War II, and they tuned in via shortwave radio to both Germany and Japan. And these men and women sat there patiently, quietly, listening through the crackling noise, waiting to hear about an American POW so that they could send a message on to his family to let him know that he was in fact alive, captured, and being held as a POW.
And I understand in some cases, people were discouraged from doing this. The government didn't want them to hear all the propaganda that was coming across those airwaves, but these people did it anyway.
Absolutely. The president had handed down a directive, and he said all hamming was banned for the duration of the war, meaning we didn't want anyone communicating over shortwave radio with anybody else. And that makes perfect sense. But on the other side of that were the shortwave listeners and the ham operators who said, well, I'm not going to communicate, so I'll comply with the directive, but I'm not going to turn it off. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to listen, and I'm going to see if the information that I get from the radio could be meaningful to somebody else. But there were a lot of magazine articles at the time discouraging people from listening because they were concerned that everything you heard over the radio might in fact be a lie, might not be true, and so they didn't want you spreading messages to family members in the event that information was inaccurate. But in this case, in fact, the information was not only accurate, it was very warmly received by a family like mine.
Well, and that takes me to my next question. This is just not some theoretical thing for you. It's not something that you were researching and stumbled across because you thought it was an interesting topic. This hits very close to home for you. Your grandfather died when you were very young. You never knew a whole lot about his time in the service during World War II. You probably knew that he was a prisoner of war. But tell us about how you stumbled on to the material that became World War II Radio Heroes, the book.
Well, that's exactly right. My grandfather meant so much to me. He passed on when I was 11, but he was such an amazing presence in my life that I often did things to honor him. I went to work for the American Legion in my early 20s in Washington, D.C., really to pay tribute to men like my grandfather and women who are serving, just to say thank you. And it wasn't until 2005 that I was at my family's home in Wellsville, Pennsylvania, and I asked to go into the trunk that my grandfather had during his lifetime. We all have those boxes or those trunks where we have the contents of people that aren't with us anymore. And that trunk had been in my family as long as I could remember, but out of privacy, I just had never asked to go into it before, but something compelled me to on one holiday trip, and I discovered 70 letters from men and women all across the country, one, in fact, from California, and they had written to my family to say that my grandfather's name was heard over the German shortwave that he had been captured and he was being held as a POW. And it took me weeks, truthfully, to read through these letters and to truly understand what I was holding. I didn't understand what shortwave radio was. I didn't know who these people were that had written to my family. So it really was quite a research endeavor to just grasp the concept and then realize that these strangers had been reaching out to my family, and what an amazing gift that must have meant to my great-grandmother. It was truly just opening the trunk and finding those things that moved me to write the book.
Give us a sense, if you can, for what one of these typical letters sounds like. I mean, is it just nuts and bolts? We heard this at such and such a time, and your loved one is here. Did it get any deeper than that? What kind of letters were these?
That's really such a great question. There's 70 of them, and I would say 30 or 40 of them, roughly half, are pretty short. They're postcards. They were written on penny postcards, or even sometimes typed on penny postcards. And they would say, I'm looking at one right now, and it says, "Dear friend, probably you've already received a message similar, but I thought I'd inform you anyway. In listening to the broadcast, the shortwave on Saturday evening, I heard the following message addressed to you. Robert Spahr has arrived safely in Germany as a prisoner of war." And then they would sign their name. So some of them, roughly half, that's exactly what they said. They were handwritten, they were typed, but others are pages in length. Sometimes, particularly women writers, would talk to my great-grandmother as though they knew her, and they would try to bring her additional comfort. They would tell her what kinds of things she could send in care packages. They would tell her things like the Red Cross will get in touch with you soon, and that's how you can get in touch with Robert. Some of them would even say he was captured in North Africa. He's being transferred from a camp in southern Germany to northern Germany. So some of them are very rich and in content. And in fact, my editor called me as he was reading them for the book. He called me one night in tears talking about one particular letter. And he said, "Lisa, did you read that letter closely? It was so amazing what one person was sharing with another, given that these people are total strangers to one another." So it's a great question, because some of them are very short and to the point, and others, I remember one woman referenced, she said, "Once you get Robert's address, please send it to me, as I have arranged to have a Bible sent to each boy." Now, I don't know how many names that dear woman heard over the radio, but the fact that she was assembling this process to send these Bibles to every name that she heard was truly incredible to me. And we have a lot of those examples as well.
It sounds like such a neat book. And again, this is Lisa Spahr, author of World War II Radio Heroes, Letters of Compassion. You can find it at POWLetters.com. I've also linked that page on my page at KMJNow.com. And it's available through all the major internet sites for buying books. We're talking about these letters, Lisa, that you uncovered in that chest of your grandfather's items. I'm sure you found some other things in there, but I'm curious, before we talk about what's happened since this book was published, and I'm sure there's a lot of that to cover, have you ever been able to get any sense of how much comfort these letters brought to your great-grandmother? Did it help the family kind of keep hope alive until he finally was liberated after more than 2 years in captivity?
You know, that's probably one of the most painful pieces of this book for me, was first the fact that in 2005 I open this trunk and I find these letters. I have a very small family. I'm the only one in my generation. But no one else knew that those letters were in there. And so stumbling upon something that wasn't already well known in my family really took me back. And then the fact that my great-grandmother wasn't around for me to ask that question to was really hard for me. And not even being able to ask my grandfather what he thought about those letters upon his return and whether he tried to contact some of these people to say thank you. That was a connection I was never able to make, very sadly. But I can tell you that from my research, as I've found people who have received word back from families like mine, they all tell me how elated the family was to receive news that their soldier, their airman was alive, captured but yet still alive. So the hope is that they'll be reunited soon. And one of the men that I found, he had written over 10,000. I didn't find him alive, sadly. But during World War II, he had written more than 10,000 of these letters to waiting POW families. And I found someone that referenced his letter that he had received. And he wrote to us and said, Lisa, I've received money. They received money as a show of gratitude for the letter that they had sent to my family. And they used that money then to send other letters. Mm. It really became this amazing effort on everyone's part to make sure that these messages could reach their final destination. And truly, the message was one of hope and one of joy. People wrote in our letters, I hope this letter brings you great joy. At one time, it was around Mother's Day, and they wrote, I hope this is a wonderful Mother's Day gift for you to know that your son is alive. And that was shocking to me because I'm 35, and when I first started to look at these letters, I said, oh, how dreadful to know that your son is a prisoner of war. That must have been awful. And it wasn't until I spent more time with veterans and their family members, specifically of that era, did I realize what a great comfort these letters actually were, in contrast to how I think I would have reacted.
Finding out that your son is a POW is a lot better than finding out that he's never coming back or no one knows where he is, I suppose,
exactly.
When you put it in perspective. We need to take a commercial break, but then we'll come back with more about this book, World War II Radio Heroes, Letters of Compassion. We're talking to the author, Lisa Sparr, and you'll hear the rest of her story when Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, not to be confused with World War II Radio Heroes. That's the book that we're talking about today with the author, Lisa Sparr. You can find out more about her book at powletters.com. I've linked that website on my page at kmjnow.com. It's also available at Amazon and all of the book websites. It's a real interesting topic, and I think a lot of you have found it interesting already. Hopefully, we will continue to keep your attention as we discuss some of the issues that are covered in the book and some of the aftermath of writing the book. Now, Lisa is a fairly young woman, and she's already had this book out there. She's learned about people who lived long before she ever did, including her grandfather, who was captured in North Africa in 1943 and remained a prisoner of war until the end of the war in Europe. She doesn't know that much about his service, but what she does know is the scores of heroes, as she calls them in the title of her book, everyday Americans who took the time to let the Sparr family know that her grandfather was a prisoner of war in Europe. Now, Lisa, I'm guessing when you talk about these heroes, some of these people may have been pretty young when they wrote these letters. They're probably still alive. Were you able, in writing the book, to track down any of these people, or is that something that maybe has happened since the book was published?
As soon as I found the letters and I really understood what I was holding in my hands, I felt compelled to do two things. One was to shout this story out, this wonderful story, to as many people as I could, and we did that through writing the book. But the second thing, really done at the same time, I wanted to do was to reach out and see if we could find any of them. And I knew it would be difficult because 1943 was truly, certainly, as you said, a time I didn't live. And how many of them can I track down? And are they still in those states? Are they still alive? But we were fortunate. We found several people who were teenagers at the time they wrote the letters in 1943, and they're in their 80s. And they were still living in the same state that the letter came from, so they were relatively easy to track down. And I really just asked for a lot of help, and we put the word out to a lot of people, and the next thing I knew, my phone started ringing, and the emails and the letters started coming in. So we were fortunate to find two gentlemen who wrote letters, one in Philadelphia and one in Massachusetts. And then we were able to find scores of other people who their parent was no longer with us, but they wanted to talk with me about their experience being a young person growing up with a radio in the house and remembering their mom or their dad and recognizing what they had done for my family. So it really stretched, and it was like a tree, and every time I turned around, there was a new branch with a person sharing their story with me. It was really incredible.
Well, I think it really speaks to a common thread that I hear from all the hundreds of veterans that I've interviewed. Every single one makes a point to say times were different then. America was united. Everybody was in it together. Whether you were wearing uniform or not, you were in it together. And this, I think, really underscores that here are these people back at home ignoring that presidential directive to stay away from ham radios, tuning into these broadcasts, taking all of their time to try to serve another family and to bring a blessing to that family. It's really neat that you've captured this in this book. And I'm curious, it's been out, what, about a year now?
It's been out a year and a half, and we just released the audiobook last year as well.
And in all that time, I'm sure you've had some book signings, you've met people, you've gotten a lot of feedback. What's kind of the neatest thing that you've learned, that you've heard, that you've seen happen because of the fact that you wrote this book?
So many things, but I'll tell you one. One, whenever I do a book talk, I'm always moved, and I always come home and share the most amazing stories with my husband over the dinner table. But one of the most incredible things that happened for me was a woman in her late 30s said that her dad was in Vietnam, but he never talked about his experience, as so many veterans do not. But she gave him this book at Christmas time. It was when it first came out. And her dad, for the whole holiday, he sat there thumbing through the book and reading various pages. And he finally opened up to his family over that holiday period, and he talked about being a radio operator in Vietnam and the fact that he was the only one in his, I suppose, his squad to come back. And when she told me that, and just telling you that story now, I have chills. The communication that the book has fostered in people sharing their own stories, but using the vehicle of the book to do that, is probably the greatest gift I could ever receive from spending our 2 years researching, writing, and getting this published. Just knowing that we are helping people talk about their experiences and allow the appreciation to continue for our very brave servicemen and women, that really makes me very proud of what we've put together here.
Now, I have a feeling, and you don't hear a whole lot on the regular airwaves like the ones that we're on right now with the signal booming all over California, about ham radio operators. It is a little different world today than it was in the mid-1940s, but I have a feeling that those folks with the letters and numbers and sequence on their license plates, on license plate frames, who recognize each other that way, who spend their weekends chatting with each other one way or the other, I imagine that those people are pretty fond of this book, that maybe you have found some fans in the current day ham radio community.
I have. It's been wonderful. We've been invited to radio clubs all over Pennsylvania, and we're now even being invited throughout the country to visit with them, to share the story. We're celebrating them, and we're paying tribute to the work that they do even today, even through our disasters, the hurricanes that we have. These are the men and women that are helping us to communicate with one another. And they don't tend to receive a lot of fanfare. They don't look for it. They don't ask for it. But through this book, we've been able to highlight them. And my hope is that we can also spread the word about ham radio and ignite interest in younger people because it really is quite an art form, and it's very interesting as I've learned it. But they've really embraced us. We've been in QST Magazine. And we've really made our way around with the radio circuit. But you know what's ironic is that today there are more than 1.5 million ham operators worldwide. And in 1939, there were 51,000.
Hmm.
So there really is. You know, as I first started to research this, I thought we'd see a decline. We have the internet, we have all these other vehicles, but radio is really compelling, and there's a huge hobby toward everything radio, and we're not losing that. In fact, we're gaining, and I hope that that continues for the generations to come.
Well, and this book is certainly testament that it has served our country well with the kind of people that have been operating them and certainly were at that time in our nation's history. Lisa's been kind enough to join us today from Pittsburgh, and she hasn't even rubbed in that the Steelers and Penguins are both reigning champions. How often does that come up at one of your talks?
Yeah, it doesn't come up that often.
I'll tell you what, if you're ever in Central California, I hope that you'll let us know, and we will pass that on to the listeners, because I'm sure they will be interested in your book. I'm sure some of them listening today will be ordering the book online. Anything else that you would like to share with our audience about what you think the message behind your book is, what it was that you were trying to honor, trying to get across by telling this story?
I'll tell you, I think that the most powerful message for me was that all of us are here today, but we're not guaranteed tomorrow. And if you can record stories of your life in writing, using an audio recorder, using a video recorder, if you can just capture those things that you want your children and your grandchildren to know about you and to know the very rich points of your life, I encourage people to do that. I often work with our senior communities on capturing their stories, and you can do it. It doesn't have to be expensive, and it doesn't have to be complex. But just make sure somehow you're saving something for other people to look back on, and you're giving them kind of that spirit that embodies who you are today. I found that in my grandpa when I opened this trunk, and I also found it in those 70 people who wrote these letters, and it really has moved me beyond anything else I've ever experienced in my life. So it's really just about capturing part of who you are or your parents to save that for a rainy day, so to speak.
Amen. That's what this program's all about. So that was music to my ears. Lisa, thanks so much for talking to us today. Good luck as you travel around spreading the news about your book. And like I said, we'll be posting that on our website. Make sure everybody here knows about it. So continued success to you, and thanks for what you've done to honor veterans and honor all those ham radio operators who did their part for our country.
Thank you for having me on, Paul. Thanks so much.
All right, that's Lisa Sparr from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Again, her book is World War II Radio Heroes, Letters of Compassion. You can find more at POWLetters.com. That's linked on our website, KMJNow.com. We'll take a break and then talk to a World War II veteran. Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It was quite entertaining discussing that book with Lisa Sparr, author of World War II Radio Heroes, Letters of Compassion. Again, all that information is at our website, kmjnow.com. And I thought the perfect complement to that as a topic today would be one of our listeners who is listening not in Fresno, not in the general Fresno area, but further north, up in wine country. Joining us from Napa this afternoon is Laverne Mack, and I understand our signal carries pretty well up there, huh?
Yes, we get you loud and clear up here, and I enjoy your station very much.
Well, you were kind enough to call a few weeks back with some comments about this program. Then when I got this topic, I thought, hey, you'd be the perfect guy to talk to, because this topic of ham radio is not something that's strange to you. You actually got hooked on radio fairly young, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Right out of high school, I lucked out. At that time, the war was, I graduated from high school in 42, and at that time, the war was, of course, going, and I got into a radio school, and that was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life, and that then went on, and when I was then called to into the service in the spring of 43, that education in radio school was greatly to my advantage, and they automatically put me right into the Signal Corps, and that's, I'd say, the best thing that ever happened to me in my life.
Now, when you talk about going to radio school, what was it about radio that kind of captured your attention? Why, this was only about 20 years old, I guess, at that point. Radio hadn't been around that long.
No. Well, I was born and raised on a farm back in South Dakota, and we didn't even have electricity out on the farm, for that matter, in my day. We had electricity in the towns. But somehow I was fascinated by radio, and the family, we had a radio, of course, that was operated on batteries. I think it was an old Atwater Kent. And then somewhere I met somebody, I think in high school, telling me about a crystal radio set. Well, that's enough to grab my interest. And so I built a crystal radio set, and then that sparked my way into further interest in radio. And then when I got into that radio school, what that was training for the war effort, training people, in trades that needed to be filled for the war effort. And, of course, radio, I guess, was one of them. So that was great for me.
Now, when I told you about this book that this young lady wrote about ham radio operators in the States picking up these German propaganda broadcasts and passing on the information about POWs to the families, had you ever heard of anything like that happening?
No, no. Speaking of ham radios, however, during the course of my trade school education there at the radio school, it happened to be in Rapid City, South Dakota, I picked up enough to take the test to become an amateur ham, but at that time they weren't issuing licenses. So that's as far as my ham radio work ever went. But
weren't issuing licenses because they didn't want people listening to all that propaganda.
I don't know what it was. I don't know what the reason was, but that was moot anyway, because I had better things to do, like go serve my country, and I wasn't going to get into ham at that date, and I never pursued it afterwards either. I just never got back into it.
So Uncle Sam did get a hold of you.
But I think it's wonderful that there were ham operators that were, passing the word to keep people in touch and one thing or another. That's one of them.
The message I got from it is something that that you and a lot of veterans have told me, was that everybody was in it together. Everybody felt unified behind the cause. You knew who you were fighting. You knew what you were fighting for. And I guess those kind of efforts weren't that uncommon during that time.
Yes. Well, when the call came, I waited to be drafted because I wanted to get as much education at that radio school as I could. And they drafted me from the school. But I got a very favorable recommendation, and I'm sure that helped when I went down to Fort Snelling to be inducted. And my time had come, and as had a lot of other people's times had come. So I was glad to do my thing, and it seemed after basic training out at Camp Kohler near Sacramento, there was a period there when I wasn't very busy doing anything, and they shipped a bunch of us up to Moscow, Idaho, to the college up there to get us out of the way, I think, for a while. So waiting for the radio school to open up down at Camp Crowder, Missouri.
It wasn't during winter that you had to go to Moscow, was it?
Oh, it was in winter.
But for a South Dakota boy, that's nothing, I guess.
Yeah, it was. But it was an interesting experience. But so then I finished my training there in Missouri at Camp Crowder, and then back out to California, Camp Kohler again, and then spent some time. And about that time, in the fall of 44, my time had come, and there's an entry in the diary I was keeping at the time that says, "This is it." And that was the last page in my diary. We weren't allowed to take diaries with us overseas. So that was...
Now, when you wrote, "This is it," what were you thinking? Were you excited to go over? Were you anxious? Were you scared? What was going through your mind?
No, I think I was thinking just about time. I got to do something besides going to school. What am I going to tell my kids and my grandchildren? So I think I was anxious to get over there and do my thing. And of course, when they ship out, we put us on a ship and we zigzag all the way over to Holland and New Guinea for staging. And we didn't know where we were going, but we knew we were headed towards a war somewhere, and we knew it was in the Pacific. And we got some reinforcement of that as we were approaching Hollandia, New Guinea. We when one day there was an announcement over the loudspeaker. They came out something like this. This is the chaplain speaking. Holy Communion on deck in 5 minutes. Well, that kind of sent a signal to us that we were getting pretty close to that war zone, if you know what I mean. So that sobered us up a little bit, you know. And then...
Now, what kinds of duties were you assigned in the Signal Corps? What were your responsibilities?
My training was to operate a radio transmitter station, which I did. I helped set one up in New Guinea. And then shortly after that, MacArthur went on up and returned to the Philippines on Leyte Island. And then a couple weeks after he did that, then they shipped us up there to Leyte to again set up a radio transmitter station for him to communicate with the rest of the world. And that was what we did.
So MacArthur would have been pretty upset with you if you had trouble setting up that radio station.
Yes, I think he would have. I think he would have. But we were at 8th Army Headquarters. That's where MacArthur was hanging out there. And then, of course, later after they captured Leyte, and then they continued the war up on Luzon Island and so forth. So then he moved his headquarters up to Manila after they secured a good hotel or something for him up there. And then I later was shipped up to Manila also.
Now, did you ever run into him? Did you ever get a whiff of that corncob pipe?
Well, he was around, but you know, there's something you learn early in life when you're in the service. You try to avoid the brass as much as you can.
Smart man.
Yeah, he was a fine man, though. He was a fine man. I've always had admiration for him. Unfortunately, he got a little disfavor with one of our presidents a few years later, but then I couldn't do anything about that.
No, I don't think that. I think he did that all on his own accord. I don't think you had anything to do with it. Now, you just described setting up the radio station there on Leyte after he had landed. He said, "I shall return," and he waited ashore there with everyone watching. You said that very matter-of-factly. I imagine it's not just a matter of showing up, taking a box out, and putting the pieces together. How do you know that it's going to work, and how much effort and really expertise is really involved in something like that?
Well, it's interesting that you should bring up that subject, because what actually happened is we had to go out into the ocean to retrieve our transmitter. Why it got dumped in the ocean, I don't know. We had to go out and get that transmitter and bring it into shore and get it workable. I don't know, maybe there was an emergency or something, another kamikaze after the transport ship or something. I don't know what the deal was.
So your transmitter was floating
in the ocean? We had to go out and retrieve that from salt water and make that thing workable. But
was it in a box or anything, or it's just loose out
there? Oh, I suppose it was crated, you know, and so forth. But,
okay.
But, you know, electronics gear, they don't like to, electronics and water don't mix.
So you got on the island, went to set up this radio station, and realized you had no transmitter?
Well, yeah. Well, we knew it was somewhere, but it wasn't in our immediate presence, and we found out later it was out there in the ocean somewhere. I don't know where. How far out it was. Somebody must have had to dump it in an emergency. And as I mentioned to you earlier in the little chat we had, as we were approaching the Leyte Island there, about a mile offshore, I guess, we were greeted by a kamikaze. And at the time, of course, we didn't know the word kamikaze, but all we knew was that, you know, looked up in the sky and here's this airplane coming straight at us. So I just, by the luck of the gunnery of the Austrian ship, you know, the gunners, they took good care of him. But I suppose maybe that had something to do with that transmitter getting dumped in the ocean so they could get the hell out of there.
Now I get the timeline a little better. And I'll tell you what, speaking of time, we need to catch a commercial break here. But when we come back, we'll talk more about kamikazes and radio stations and World War II with Laverne Mack of Napa. This is Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
I promised you I'd wait. strictly single old. I walk alone because to tell you the truth, I'll be lonely. I don't mind being lonely when my heart tells me you are lonely too. I walk alone. They'll ask me.
Bringing back some memories with Dinah Shore, that song, I'll Walk Alone, played at the request of our guest today, Laverne Mack. Once upon a time, that was the song that he and his bride, Marion, enjoyed. Now, she wasn't your bride when you met her before you went overseas, but I imagine after you met this lovely lady just a few weeks before you set off for the other side of the world, that maybe that was a little motivation to come home, huh?
Well, it certainly was. It certainly was, and I felt very lucky to have discovered her.
And you two weren't communicating via ham radio, but you were writing letters back and forth.
Oh, indeed we were. Indeed we were. I recall, I think we were numbering them, as I recall, and some would, once in a while, one would come up missing, you know, and so forth. And then, of course, once in a while, they would be censored, and there'd be a few words cut out. You know, I guess over there we had to turn our letters into the officers who would then do the censoring. And it was only about, I think, the 50th anniversary of the end of the war, I went through and read all those letters that my wife had saved, and I found out the censoring and so forth. And, you know, they use a razor blade. They just cut something out, you know. You'd have to just kind of guess what was there.
So some of those letters looked like Swiss cheese, huh?
Yeah, you know, and of course, it couldn't have been anything too confidential. But, you know, they had to exercise their authority and do what they were told to do. So they'd clip something out now and then, you know. That's the name of the game.
Now, I want to get back to what you were doing as you wore that uniform, serving with the Signal Corps in the Pacific. You mentioned before the break about a kamikaze, and here you are, you're headed for Leyte. You know what's going on there, that you're going to have to go ashore and set up a radio station once MacArthur's back there. But you're on this ship, an Australian ship, and you see an airplane headed right for you. What's going through your mind at a moment like that?
Well, I was on the HMAS Westralia. That's an Australian ship, and we were just barely moving along, and we were supposed to be below deck, but you know how it is. We'd been on that ship, I don't know how long, our fatigue, we were growing mold on our clothes, and we tried to get up above deck as much as we could. But anyway, I just happened to look up. I can still see it today, looking up to my right, at about 45 degrees, and here's this airplane coming straight at us. I thought, gee, that's funny. You know, when's he going to turn away? Well, he didn't turn away until the Australian gunners, they opened up on him, and he hit the water about 100 yards distance from the ship. So that was a pretty close call, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, I guess without those Australian gunners, Marion would have been awfully mad at you for not coming home.
Yeah, well, we're sure they knew their stuff, and I've since learned, of course, at that time the word kamikaze was not in our vocabulary, but that's something, you know, you learn after the war, that they had a name for them. All I could knew was that somebody was coming at us, and apparently he had bad intentions, but then we learned, you know, after the war, we learned later they called them kamikaze.
So perhaps it was at that moment that the crate containing the transmitter you needed got dumped into the ocean.
That could well be. It could well be. When, and then we all, after that incident, there were no more kamikazes, so then we all went over the side and on rope ladders, you know, with our duffel bags and so forth, and our little rifles. We had a rifle, but they didn't give us any ammunition. You know, we weren't soldiers. We were just technicians.
But you looked the part.
they put us on shore, you know, with our rifles, but no ammunition. They wanted to be safe that we didn't cause any more damage, you know. So that was funny. I never will forget that. And then we get on shore that night, you know, first night there on the beach. It's the same beach where MacArthur landed there, you know, and nice, beautiful sand beach and palm trees and everything. And, oh, boy, here we hear some shot somewhere, you know. And, you know, like I say, being technicians, you know, we thought, gee, we thought this place was secure. We don't know what that shot was about, but we left the fighting to somebody else, you know, and we did our thing.
And good thing. And,
yeah.
And I know that you're thankful for that. But you did finally get that transmitter. You got this radio station set up there on Lady. What kinds of communication was going through there? And once you actually had it set up, what kinds of things were you responsible for?
Well, they were sending out facsimile messages, you know, naturally to something to make it hard for anybody to interpret. And I think we were sending it out to specifically to Australia, and then probably it went around the world by some other means from there. And probably it helped General MacArthur keep in touch with his wife, who was in Australia at that time, you know, his own private connection to Australia, I don't know, but I understand she stayed there in Australia for a while after he landed, you know, and so forth, because it wasn't the safest place for wives to be.
And how long were you in the Philippines? Did you move anymore before the end of the war? Did they bounce you around?
Yeah, well, after the war ended in August, I think, 45, I'm still there in Leyte. And then late one afternoon, we got a notice to be aboard a C-47 in 40 minutes.
That's not a whole lot of time to pack your things.
Not when you have a monkey and a parrot and all your stuff, you know, to get ready. So
I didn't realize I was talking to Dr. Doolittle here.
So we were groups, you know, maybe 6, 8, 10 of us. We're just little groups that they kept together. And we were on aboard the C-47. I had to leave my parrot, but I took my monkey with me. And matter of fact, I brought my monkey Gwendolyn back to the States with me when I came. Kept her all that time.
So you're telling me that all this time you're writing letters to this lovely gal back in the States.
Yeah.
You're telling her all about what you're doing and how you can't wait to see her, and then you show up with a monkey tagging along?
Well, no, like I say, in the letters we really couldn't tell much of anything what we were doing.
Oh, so you couldn't tell her about the monkey. That's your excuse.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I could have told her about the monkey, but anything to do with the war effort, you know.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Was she surprised to see the monkey?
So, yeah. And I ended up, you know, having second thoughts. I needed to get back to my hometown in South Dakota, my parents and so forth back there. So I went back there for a couple months, and I decided that wasn't monkey country back there, you know, in the middle of the winter. So I took her out to the Sacramento Zoo, and I guess that's where she probably stayed until her death. I presume she's...
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, you know, she needed a home. So.
Well, tell me about this. We've got about 2 minutes left in the show here. What was that reunion like? Because I'm sure, especially when that kamikaze was coming at you, and I'm sure there are other times too, you weren't always absolutely positive that you were going to make it home. But when you did make it home, and when you saw that smiling face again and reunited with Marion, what was that moment like for you?
Yeah, well, it's a moment you've been waiting for a long time. And she was living in a boarding house. She was working for the government. In fact, she was working out at Mather Air Base there near Sacramento at the time. And it was pretty neat, you know. January 17th was the date I was discharged from Camp Beale, which is up north of Sacramento near Marysville. That was a discharge center.
Yep.
And so, you know, naturally I was on the first bus I could get to Sacramento. And yeah, it was pretty nice. And anticipating maybe a little, getting to know her a little better somewhere in that period of time while I stayed there in Sacramento. And before I went back to see my folks, I chose to buy a diamond ring. And I asked her if she would accept it. and she said that she would. So that was beginning of our union.
And 63 years later,
yeah,
she's still putting up with you.
She's still putting up with me. Yeah, well, you know, life is wonderful, and we have our little ills and so forth. She's quite a bit of arthritis and things like that, but, you know, that's life, I guess. So.
But things worked out pretty well for the young boy from South Dakota. Unfortunately, we're out of time on the program today, but I want to thank you for serving our country. Thanks for being on the program with me today, and I'm glad to know every week that you will be listening up there in Napa.
I do, and indeed keep up the good work. I enjoy your program so much.
Well, thank you very much. That's Hometown Heroes for today. It's News Talk 580 KMJ.